people they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and wanting peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh yeah, fuck the police. Actors and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You could pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means, APAC, Koofy, and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You could ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late. We've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children, and all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the color of your pigment. But white supremacy is finally on blast, screaming free Palestine to their home at last. We see the lies and claiming it's anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist. I seen Jewish brothers and sisters out there and writhing in solidarity and screaming free Palestine with them organizing and learning and finally cutting ties with a state that's gotta rely on apartheid systems to uphold and occupy and violent history been repeating for the last 75. The NECPA never ended, the colonizer lied. It's students in tents posted on the lawn, occupying the quad is really against the law. And a reason to call and the police and their squad were to genocide land and your definition.
All right, I'm Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. I'm joined as always by our super producer, Jake Appett, and our very talented graphic designer, Jay Andrew World. I was just thinking as I was listening to that, because I can't turn off the part of my brain that's like, oh yeah, no, I agree with that. I don't know that line, whatever, right? It's like how insanely context inappropriate that is, that like, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm gonna spend like the next hour breaking down line by line, you know, like the exact nitpicky critique of that song. But I actually enjoyed it, you know, give the man credit for putting that out.
Yeah, well, you got to do like that Jordan Peterson video when he did line by line on the Ben Shapiro video. You got to do your own version for.
Yeah, that's all we're going to do tonight is it's like rate the percentage of political on pointness of like every turn of phrase.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean the man's gotten a lot of hate, so I actually, especially with all the attention on another rap story, I do got to give him credit for. There was some substance in there too. Like, it's kind of educational, you know, so
these dads on the right side of history and appreciate.
I still like thrift shops, you know. I can't co-sign the song. It was pretty ubiquitous when I was in college, but he was right, you know, at the end of the day. It's
making some good points there too. Yeah, but, yeah. Appreciate the line about the Jewish brothers and sisters, you know, out in the protests. So speaking of the protests, I actually had just gotten back to the West Coast late last night. On Friday, I gave a teach-in at the encampment at Princeton. That is a little graphic of that. I really like that image because of the disconnect between the sort of general portrayal of these encampments in corporate media as these like foaming at the mouth mob of like Hamas loving anti-Semites who are probably going to try, you know, start like firing homemade rockets, you know, at administration buildings at any moment. And like what you see in that image, which is just like any group of college kids who are sitting out on the lawn on a nice day for like an outdoor lecture.
That was at the beginning of your speech. By the end, they were screaming intifada, and going to take over. Hatred. Yeah.
They tried to take some pictures at the end, but everything was on fire and the smoke, you know, meant that there was no good pictures possible.
And everybody just assumed because it's in New Jersey, that's just normal.
No, nobody even associated it with the all the terrorism that was going on by the end of the speech. But yeah, exactly. So later in the show, we are going to be joined by Electra, who is Greek last name, I'm afraid to try to pronounce. I have, you know, anybody who's ever seen me try to call a roll will know that that like there is a rainbow patchwork of kinds of names that, you know, that I have an amazing ability to fuck up. But Electra is a professor at Rutgers, and she is a organizer with the Uncommitted campaign in New Jersey, and she's done stuff with the Palestine encampments at Rutgers, you know, Rutgers Newark, I believe, and this also relates to the academic work that she does. So we're going to be talking to Electra in the last part of the main show, and then she's going to be sticking with us for the post game for patrons. But before that, we have you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. So I have written three things for Jacobin in the last 2 weeks, and two of them are going to be relevant to the discussion for with Electra. But so we're going to hold those for then because they're about the student protests. But there's also an article called Freedom Under Capitalism Isn't All It's Cracked Up to Be, which is an idea I've had for a little while for something I wanted to write, which is a response to a very common kind of libertarian argument against socialism. So it's one that Robert Nozick makes in a couple of parts of Anarchy, State, and Utopia. It's one Jason Brennan makes toward the end of Why Not Capitalism. And, you know, it's certainly one like Gene Epstein made in his debates with Bhaskar Sankar, Richard Wolff, and me a few years ago. And all three of them, he made versions of this argument, which is basically you know, capitalism is already all the utopia you should ask for. In fact, Nozick says it's a framework for utopias because you can, you know, you can do what you want. So what these guys like Nozick and Brennan and Epstein will say is, hey, look, you care about workplace democracy? No problem. Right? Go start up a co-op. And you know, the rules of capitalism let you do that, right? You can have you know, worker co-ops and socialist communes, you know, kibbutzes within capitalism, but you, you can't have private enterprise within socialism. So, so if you think, you know, people are different, you know, what's the best kind of, you know, what counts as utopia for me might not be utopia for thee. So really capitalism is better because it gives you this whole, you know, framework for utopias. So, Brennan says, for example, in Why Not Capitalism, that, you know, referring to, you know, my favorite, philosopher, in the late 20th century, G.A. Cohen, you know, who's obviously a socialist, he says, Cohen gives us a portrait of utopia, Nozick gives us a whole gallery, because, you know, says it's like a whole art gallery, you know, for all the different portraits of utopia, because you're just allowed to start any of them within the rules of capitalism. And I think if you're already a convinced socialist, it's easier to roll your eyes at that. But I also think that a lot of people might not kind of see, you know, some of what's wrong with that. So, you know, a lot of that's what I wanted to explore in the article. Because it is true, you know, and so Nozick says, for example, that within capitalism, you know, there's this, you know, nothing is stopping you, right? You know, if you want to just, you know, that like people who think that workers should control the means of production can just get together a group of workers and just buy some space and some equipment like any other entrepreneurs. And whereas he says it's much harder to see how private enterprise could get going in a socialist system. And so, you know, one preliminary point, you know, I want to make about this is that this is of course, there are, you know, lots of worker co-ops that have existed under capitalism. Nozick writes about this as if it's sort of hypothetical. And he's like, oh, it's an interesting question why groups of workers don't do this. It's like, well, no, lots have, right? You know, the Mondragon Corporation, you know, see Richard Wolff talk about this. He talks about it all the time, right? In the Basque country of Spain, has like 80,000 worker owners. But the germ of truth in Nozick's point is that it's not, you know, worker co-ops under capitalism are always microscopic by the standards of the overall economy, right? Like even Mondragon's 80,000 members is rounding error compared to the tens of millions of Spaniards who are employed by regular capitalist companies. But I think the more we kind of dig into why that is, right, I think the less compelling the libertarian argument starts to get, because I think that, you know, that one obvious point you can make about this is, look, you could say this about anything, right? Like you can say, like, think about raising the minimum wage, incredibly popular demand. There are, you know, there's tons of polling to show that most people support that. Ballot referendums to raise the minimum wage in individual states routinely win, even in red states. In Florida, in the last presidential election, Trump won, but the $15 minimum wage resolution won by more. And if you were going to argue like Nozick, you could say, well, or like Gene Epstein or any of these people, you could say, well, look, if they really wanted that, they could have just all committed to buying from companies that paid people at least $15 an hour, and they could have, you know, they could have succeeded in getting a $15, you know, wage floor, you know, with that. And what's stopping them? And I say, well, I think what's stopping them is collective action problems, that even though voters and consumers are the same people, there are, you know, different incentives that are created by different kinds of situations, and it's easier to get people together collectively in context like workplace organizing with labor unions or like political organizing at the ballot box than it is at consumers, which is when people are consumers, which is actually when they're at their very most atomized. And then I think especially if you think about, you know, attempts to start, you know, worker co-ops, then one, you know, immediate problem with that is that it's the, you know, if you're starting worker co-ops within the rules of regular, you know, capitalist markets, then it's just not the case that the incentives of those markets really favor that, right? Because anybody whose goal is non-ideological, they're just trying to get a better life for themselves. Well, look, starting a new business venture of any kind is incredibly risky. The vast majority of them fail. And so it's, you know, you're taking a bit of a leap of faith anytime you start any kind of business. But within the rules of regular capitalist marketplaces that, you know, allow for, you know, single person ownership, partnerships, you know, shares, all that stuff. Look, if your only goal is to get a better life and you're already taking a huge risk anyway, I mean, why not shoot the moon, right? Like why settle for a little bit more power as a co-equal democratic member of a co-op rather than becoming, you know, the king of your own little economic kingdom? Which those rules allow for. And so it seems to me that a lot of what, you know, people say, oh, well, if you really wanted to do this, if people wanted this, why wouldn't they just do it like this? A lot of what they're ignoring is collective action problems. So like, you know, I think if we got a little clip, I linked this in the article about the prisoner's dilemma.
The prisoner's dilemma is one example of something game theory studies. Let's assume Alice and Tom are caught stealing wallets. Game theory assumes they're both rational and self-interested. The regular punishment for what they did is 1 year in jail each. However, let's also assume the police expects one of them was involved in a more serious offense, stealing valuable paintings from a museum. Alice is offered a deal by the police. If she testifies against Tom for the more serious crime, and Tom doesn't testify against her, she gets zero jail time, but Tom gets 8 years. Tom gets the same offer. If none of them testifies, each person only gets 1 year in jail. If both of them testify, they get 3 years each. Obviously, it seems in their best interest that neither of them testifies, as only 2 years of total jail time would result, one for each. However, let's look at things from their perspective. Alice sees that if she doesn't testify, there are two outcomes, one in which she gets 1 year and one in which she gets 8. She then sees that if she testifies, she either gets 0 jail time or 3 years. Testifying, therefore, seems more appealing. The same thing goes for Tom. Game theory therefore predicts that both of these rational, self-interested people would end up testifying and receiving 3 years each. Definitely not the ideal outcome.
So, you know, this is the kind of thing that that happens all the time, right? Things that might benefit everybody collectively, right? When people are just making individual decisions in environments where, you know, they're, you know, that it's very hard to coordinate between large groups of people, like consumption, right? People end up making, you know, decisions that individually make sense for them, but might not collectively lead to the best result. If you could, you know, I suppose hypothetically convince everybody to only patronize companies that paid at least $15 an hour, you could get the $15 wage floor without getting the law involved. If you could convince everybody to only patronize worker co-ops, then, you know, I suppose you could get a sort of very unstable form of workers' control of production, you know, that way without political action. Although I think even there, it would collapse right back into something much more recognizable as standard capitalism if you still had the rules of standard capitalist markets. Because, you know, some firms succeed, some firms fail. When firms, you know, fail, people need new jobs. If they've been out of work for long enough, they have an incentive to take just regular wage labor contracts. And meanwhile, the, you know, rules of standard capitalist markets give co-ops the incentive to offer, you know, to expand by taking people on as wage laborers rather than as full members, which even Mondragon has done in many cases, especially when they've expanded outside of the Basque region of Spain, you know, which is their home turf. And again, if everybody's just sort of pursuing individually rational market decision making, that is the predictable result. Whereas it's much easier to overcome those kinds of collective action issues in environments like workplace organizing or political organizing through the ballot box, where it's much easier to get people to make decisions based on those sorts of larger scale collective considerations. And certainly, proof's in the pudding. There are all these places where, you know, the minimum wage has been raised through political action, and there's zero places where the wage floor has been raised through consumer action. So if we're just curious which of these things is going to be more effective, then it's not a very hard question. So I think really when people say, like, you know, when libertarians say, oh, why don't you just do that, right? Then I think that the power of the question really comes from an ambiguity. Is what they're saying, well, would it be more efficient for you to do it? In which case the answer is clearly not, right? Check out the empirical results in the real world. But what they're really saying is, oh, isn't this the only legitimate way you could do it? Or isn't this like a more honorable way or something, right? You know, you're not doing coercive things through the state. But at that point, you're just begging the question, because the issue and dispute between socialists and libertarians is not just like what's going to have better results, right? If we have workplace democracy or not, if we have higher, you know, minimum wages or not, et cetera. It's also, do we actually think capitalists have a right to own the means of production? Do we think that the sort of existing division in our property, in our society, is just, and everybody's entitled to whatever they get from letting the chips fall where they may in a free market? Do we think that the means of production should be controlled by whoever has the money to buy them up? Because when you're saying, oh, the only legitimate way to do this is for you to buy them up, then, you know, you're just assuming that principle that whoever has the money should control them. And of course, in a way, it would be like asking why early abolitionists didn't just try to buy up all the slaves and give them their freedom, or asking why early small R Republicans didn't just like intensively lobby, you know, the heir to the throne to allow more power to Parliament. And part of the answer to that question is that, you know, the abolitionists didn't just want the outcome, right, of more people not being slaves, although they certainly wanted that, right? They also disputed the idea that anybody could have like legitimate ownership rights in human beings. Early, you know, Republicans, in the good sense, not the unsavory contemporary political organization, early Republicans didn't just want more power for parliaments. They disputed the right of kings to rule. And socialists don't just want more workplace democracy, though obviously we want that. We dispute the fundamental idea that whoever can afford to buy up the means of production therefore should run it, rather than the workers and communities whose lives can be destroyed by decisions that you make about what to do with those means of production. And, you know, and I guess the last point about this to wrap up the monologue would just be, look, when you say, why don't you just, you know, why don't you just buy up, you know, means of production or whatever, and, you know, and you say, well, it's good that capitalism allows for you to do like socialism on a small scale, and it's bad that socialism doesn't let you do capitalism on a small scale. Well, first of all, contra nozick, it's actually very easy to see how some private enterprise would start within a comprehensively socialist system in the sort of good socialist democracy sense. Just convince a majority of the voters to privatize some stuff. Done. Right? I think that the sort of lack of confidence that they'd be able to win people over to that is incredibly telling in itself. And look, it's true that the sort of people are incredibly different. We should have a society where there are not only individually but collectively a huge different number of different ways for people to live their lives. We're not imposing our sort of ideas about, you know, what counts as a good collective existence on each other. All totally true. But, you know, my question is, look, if you want to let people run 1,000 experiments about how to run their lives so some people can, you know, have, you know, big houses with white picket fences and they and their huge family goes to like Catholic mass every morning, and other people get to, you know, I don't know, live in polyamorous compounds where everybody's using drugs we haven't even heard of every night or whatever, right? We have a wide variety of different forms of life going on. Well, it's all very well to tell people that they can do that stuff, but right now most people can't afford to buy a house, right? Or, you know, have kids if they want. Lots of people who, you know, not most people anyway, but a great many people who like would like to have, say, a couple of kids, never mind that huge Catholic family we're just talking about, can't even do that, right? Like, you might love to go experiment, but if you're preoccupied by being financially stressed, you're probably not going to be doing a lot of experimentation of any kind. So seems to me that you really want the utopia of utopias, then you need to do something about the wildly unequal distribution of resources, which is downstream of private ownership of the means of production. And Jeff Bezos can have his own spaceship while people who work for Amazon often have to get second jobs because he gets to decide how the pie is divided up because he owns it. Where, you know, whereas in under socialism, that wouldn't be the case. So I think that would be the real framework for utopias.
Yeah. I mean, I think two things really quick. First of all, in terms of like his, you know, I don't. Oh, the idea of like, oh, you know, if you really wanted to, you could do all these things like having a minimum wage or starting worker co-ops. Just it's interesting for me to imagine what would happen if that actually started to happen. How would the capitalists react? Do you know what I mean? Like the capitalists that have so, like the Bezos of the world that have so much. You think they would just be like, okay, I guess it's happening. The public, just, you know, the tide of opinion has turned against me. So I guess everyone's only going to patronize. But I don't see it. I think it's a little bit ignoring what would actually happen with existing.
Yeah,
I'm wrong here. I just don't think that really.
Ron DeSantis wants to literally ban lab grown meat because it's like.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, let's return to it another day because this is a little bit of a half baked idea I have. But for me, what it kind of reminds me of, I know they'd have their own answer to this, but they're like, you know, some things in life you just kind of have to coordinate with each other, right? And it's difficult, so you have to have some kind of like project manager. It'd be difficult. So like, let's say you wanted to build a bridge and they say, hey, you know, you can't cordon off any of the space, you can't, you know, make a blueprint. It's just like, if people really want a bridge to exist, then they would just come together and make it happen. I don't know if my metaphor makes sense yet, but I just think that there's something really off on their idea of how for anything to actually have, like, sometimes, you know, there has to be some kind of like project overseer to say, hey, for you guys to make, you know, to make this bridge, you have to, like, I'm going to help you organize it. You know, it's not going to just come up spontaneously through like atomized individual, like all the people who need the bridge are just going to get to get, you know, like take off from work and go, you know, and make the plans together. It just seems ridiculous.
There's never been an intercontinental railroad that was built by people volunteering in spare time, right? This is, massive projects of social coordination, like a really good system for pulling them off is democracy, because as you say, you do need an operational overseer, right? Like all complex institutions require a certain amount of operational hierarchy and practice to get stuff done. The real question and dispute is whoever is like in positions of decision-making power democratically accountable to everybody else or not, right? Like, so if you just have whoever has the most, you know, enough money can buy stuff up and then they get to decide what to do with it, then the answer is no. Right. If the system, on the other hand, is that we all own it collectively, then the answer is yes. Of course, certainly things that shouldn't be under the purview of democracy, because everybody should just be able to do whatever they want individually. But like, I would say those tend to be the things that have the least impact on other people who aren't voluntary participants, and the most impact just on you. Right. So like, if, you know, what you want to do with your own body, you know, what kind of relationships you want to enter into, what kind of religious beliefs you want to have, right? Those are things that mostly impact you, right? Whereas, you know, to take the example I used at the beginning of the article, like some giant factory that employs half of the town, whether it should like relocate to another town, that's a decision that impacts a lot of people. And it seems reasonable that that they should have some say in this. I do want to move on because we're already running a little bit late. But the last thing I want to say, I guess I'm going to just very briefly set up what we're going to watch, and I have a related thing. So the related thing is that next Sunday, May 12th, going to start the new Capital class. So this is. This is going to be every Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Zoom, because over the years of doing classes at different places, this is the time that I figured out works for the most people in the most time zones, because that's like 10 to noon in L.A. and like, I don't know, pretty early evening if you're in Paris. So, you know, it's so, yeah, 1 to 3 p.m. EST. We're going to start out next Sunday with the prefaces in the first chapter, and the plan is to just keep on trucking until we get through the end of volume 3 this time, right? Since last time we did it, we just did volume 1. So really excited about that. I've actually been reading a bunch of Capital again. You know, I taught a whole volume 1 class before, but I've been, you know, dipping into it a lot again to get ready to start teaching this version, and it's fun. It's like a really... I know if you've only read, like a lot of people start reading groups and they only get to like, I don't know, they like give up somewhere in the first few chapters where they're, you know, a lot of it's very dry and abstract. There are a zillion examples about like the exchange value of yards of linen. And if you kind of think the whole book's going to be like that, it's very easy to check out at that point. But I promise you the whole book is not like that at all, right? Like Marx is an incredibly good writer. And when he really gets into his main project in that book, which is about class analysis, you know, I mean, a lot of the example, you know, I mean, the examples are drawn from, you know, from England, and, you know, and a lot of in a period where, you know, it was this Dickensian horror show, and Marx is incredibly eloquent, and, you know, I mean, if you don't sort of have the thought at least once every few pages, fuck, that's a good point. That's a really interesting way that he said that. Then I don't know, maybe you just were raised wrong or something. But in any case, it, you know, for me in my time zone, it's 10 to noon on Sundays. So I actually really enjoy that as a way of starting my Sunday. I spend a couple hours talking about Capital. And I miss it from when we did the previous class. So I'm really looking forward to that. If you want to sign up for the class, that's patreon.com/BenBurgess. You know, so that's like the same place you sign up as a patron for the show. But, you know, you can just select the other tier and sign up for the class. When I started to teach the first Capital class, I was doing it at Michael Albert's thing, the School for Social and Cultural Change. And that one was, and they had like a sliding scale based on income. It's like a little bit harder to set it up that way in the Patreon. So I just did, I just set it at what the SSCC like low income tier was for everybody for this one. So, that was like, you know, $60 for a 2-month class. So this is, you know, so this is just breaking that down on a month by month. Nice, Topher. Marxist Leninism, I like it. So, with that, let's watch the main event for tonight. So I did, speaking of Marx, I did a discussion, essentially a friendly debate with Spencer Case, who is a philosophy podcaster, and he is I am not filming from my childhood bedroom or my bedroom at all. I will give you a glimpse behind the veil to these extremely exciting personal details. I had so while I was in the tri-state this last weekend doing the teach-in at Princeton, and I was also the keynote at the Green Party of New Jersey convention in Toms River, and did some other stuff while I was there. So producer Jordan was dog sitting, and she's in San Diego. So since I was in San Diego anyway, that's where I flew back to at the end of the weekend. I came down because it's like just an hour of drive from there to Rosarito. This is Jason Miles, guest room behind you, but in any case, behind me rather, but in any case, yeah. So, you know, I like to you know, my relationship to rock music is that I enjoy listening to it. Maybe someday. So Russell Sobriglia, past guest, has a band. He does the exact kind of music that I like. So maybe someday he'll let me write some lyrics or something, but that'll probably be as close as I ever get to the production end of things. But, in any case, so Spencer, Case is a philosophy podcaster, and, you know, he's definitely, you know, a right-leaning guy in many ways that comes out over the course of the discussion, but I think he's also a very like thoughtful interlocutor and really honestly, I mean, he's as conservative-ish people go, he's pretty chill. And so in any case, but he certainly doesn't like Marx as much as I do, which is the main subject here. So with that, we are going to watch this, and then we are going to be joined by our guest for the remainder of the show, Electra from Rutgers, when this is over.
Welcome to Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case. Hopefully, welcome back to Microdigressions. I hope it's not your first time joining us. Today, I'm here with Ben Burgess. How are you doing, Ben?
I'm good. I hope it is their first time listening that I've brought some sort of amazing bump to the show, but you know, perhaps it won't be.
Oh, that would be good. Yeah. Amazing bumps are good. So, how would you describe yourself? I'd say a left-wing pundit, but I don't mean that in a bad way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't love the term pundit, but you know, I could accept commentator.
And what are you working on right now?
Right now, I am writing something for Jacobin that's about the campus protests that have been going on about Gaza, and I'm also writing a final exam I need to finish for my class.
Any big book projects in the works?
I do, actually, yeah. So I have, I'm co-writing something with Bhaskar Sankara from Jacobin and Mike Beggs, who is an economics professor in Australia, called The Blueprint, which is a sort of attempt to think through like a logistically feasible form of socialism that would accomplish the things that socialists want to accomplish, but, you know, wouldn't just be a, you know, economic disaster might look like.
Interesting. So last time we had a pretty wide-ranging conversation on socialism. We talked a lot about Cohen and some other stuff.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of focus more on Marx this time. Mm-hmm. And I guess your opinion on how Marx should be interpreted.
Sure.
So I remember you were saying that you weren't so keen on this idea of treating Marx as like a scientist as opposed to a moral philosopher. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that. Like, is Marx giving an empirical theory, or is he giving a moral theory, or something that has moral and empirical components?
Yeah, I'd say that last one. You know, Marx clearly has moral views, right? I mean, there's some Marxists who are very keen to deny that, but I think that the denial is pretty implausible. That, you know, that he's clearly making value judgments all the time. That's fine. And, you know, I also think that Marx is making empirical claims. Probably what we're primarily thinking of when we're talking about, you know, Marxism are empirical claims. I think to make that more concrete, I think we're mostly talking about two things. One of them is a theory of history, and in particular, a theory of how it is that different modes of production, like feudalism and capitalism and socialism, rise and fall over the course of time. And the other is a theory of how one of those specific modes of production works, which is capitalism, right? So Marx's, you know, masterpiece, Capital, is really about that second question. It's an analysis of how capitalism, you know, works, and, you know, and I think some of those claims hold up and some of them don't. And obviously it's a, you know, that's a big cluster of subjects, but of course, right? Like, I think that the reason to care about any of this, right, you know, is ultimately that, you know, you have certain kinds of normative goals that, you know, the reason to be concerned, you know, the theories of historical change beyond just intellectual curiosity and about, you know, how capitalism works, you know, I think is ultimately from Marx about a normative interest in getting rid of it.
Marx actually saw capitalism as an advance on feudalism, as an improvement.
Most definitely, yeah.
So I wonder if you take that teleological kind of view from history, he has to say as well that all of the things about capitalism that he criticizes are steps in the right direction. So, you know, Marxists are going to link colonialism and slavery and all this stuff to capitalism. They didn't just happen at the same time. They were like important aspects of the system. And I guess if Marx is going to say that capitalism is an advance on feudalism, these are just further steps in the right direction, or at least because they're playing an important causal role in where this is all headed. I worry that teleology has some like repugnant implications there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're certainly not alone on that. I mean, lots of left-wing academics are critical of Marx for similar reasons. You know, I guess I'd say a couple of things about that. There could be certainly things that are caused by the transition from feudalism to capitalism, or that, you know, or that maybe even partially constitute the transition, that are really bad, right? And presumably that's consistent with the idea that overall it's better that we have capitalism now than feudalism now. And even if we're thinking of B happening after A happens makes it more likely for C to happen in the future, then how that sort of translates into judgments about, you know, I don't know, like, let's say you were you were somehow a convinced Marxist, you know, long before Marx developed a lot of these theories, when some of those horrible developments that you're starting to talk about are starting to happen, right? I mean, like, then it's still, you know, even if you agree with the empirical judgment that this means that, you know, that this is part of a process of capitalism overriding feudalism that makes it more likely that socialism will override capitalism in the future, that by itself doesn't get us to, okay, how should people relate to those developments as they're happening, right? Should people not resist invading British troops or whatever? I mean, that seems like a normative argument that would have to be hashed out on its own terms. But I mean, like, certainly Marx is very well aware that some of what happens, you know, some of what happens in and maybe even partially constitutes that transition is really, really bad. I mean, the last section of Capital is about the enclosures of peasant land in England, which, you know, which he certainly are certainly some of the most, like, normative judgment laden parts of the book. You know, I mean, like, he's clearly horrified by the process that he's describing, right? You certainly get the sense that his sympathies would be with any peasants who are, you know, trying to resist it, even if he thinks that, like, ultimately, you know, that probably that project didn't have a great chance of success. And, you know, what we should focus on now is, you know, what this creates the conditions for in the future.
Although you see Marxism as this normatively laden, morally laden kind of thing, like, Engels certainly described Marx as, like, a counterpart to being, like a counterpart to Darwin or somebody like that, who discovered important laws. And so I'm wondering, what do you think some of the most important empirical discoveries Marx made are?
You know, I don't know that I would necessarily see things exactly the way that Engels does there, but certainly what are sort of empirical claims that Marx makes that seem important and plausibly true, right? Like, then I think that the sort of core claims of you know, historical materialism, I guess I'm gonna regress to bad habits and bring up G.A. Cohen for a second here, say that Cohen's book, Karl Marx's Theory of History, is really useful for anybody here who wants to sort of get a very, like, very clear, very rigorous, very no bullshit kind of unpacking of, like, what some of those claims are. But yeah, I think some of those claims are pretty plausible. Like, one of those core claims is that what the relations of production are, in other words, how the immediate producers, the people who are, you know, growing food, for example, or, you know, manufacturing things, how those are related to whoever's in charge of the production process in any given society. Do you have lords and serfs? Do you have slaves and slave owners? Do you have, you know, wage laborers and capitalists? That those relations of production are downstream of the development of the forces of production, the capacity of a society to produce stuff. And that seems pretty plausible to me, that they have that first claim, that the fact that, you know, you have capitalism everywhere, and, you know, it's totally wiped away feudalism and other, you know, other forms of production almost everywhere on Earth, right, seems to have a lot to do with the fact that capitalism is better than those other systems were at developing, you know, the forces of production. And I think that the fact that, like, early pre-capitalist class societies sort of mostly overwhelmed, you know, the kind of egalitarian hunter-gatherer tribes you had there, like what, you know, Marx would call primitive communism, also seems to have, you know, quite a bit to do with the sort of advantage that those systems had in developing the forces of production over primitive communism. And I think this is actually, like, maybe this one is worth lingering on for a second, because I would say, you know, because it's pretty relevant to a lot of debates that have happened sort of within the socialist left. If one of the core claims of Marxism is that capitalism wasn't just kind of an avoidable moral mistake, but something that, you know, is a necessary stage of development in terms of laying the groundwork for, you know, for what Marxists could hope can come next, right? Then, one, I think thinking back to, like, those sort of Stalin-Trotsky debates about socialism in one country, you know, whether you could sort of skip
from what was really a pre-capitalist country, which was Tsarist Russia, to socialism, you know, without the advantage of being hooked up to an industrial base somewhere else. That seems, you know, like pretty relevant to that. Or even now, right, that there are lots of people, eco-socialist kinds of people, who would say that, like, actually we want to, you know, we need to maybe roll back the global forces of production, that we should consciously degrow, you know, the world economy for environmental reasons, that, you know, there's like those debates, right? Like both seem to be really relevant, even though a lot of people with the contrary positions think of themselves as Marxists. I would say that, you know, if that's one of the sort of core empirical claims that Marx is making, then the idea in both cases that you sort of don't need an advanced, you know, technologically advanced industrial base to have socialism, you know, like that seems like, you know, if that's wrong, which I think it is wrong, then, you know, then I think that those that sort of classical Marxist claim is a big part of it. The other sort of half of that theory of history is the claim that the, you know, legal and political superstructure of a given society tends to be downstream of what the relations of production are. There's certainly like a variety of political forms that are compatible with the same economic system. That's clearly true. But I also think that in a lot of ways, the political institutions do tend to rearrange themselves around how like production is being organized at the base of society, how most people are spending most of their days, right? You know, at producing things or supervising other people producing them. So yeah, I think all that's pretty plausible. And I also think that some of the, you know, empirical claims that, you know, Marx would make about the operations of capitalism, how, you know, he thinks it is ultimately sort of a class society, the way that feudalism was, even though there are important differences. Like, I think some of those do still hold up pretty well.
I'm trying to think of what would we need to observe to falsify what Marx is saying about this. Like, the general idea that politics is like the handmaiden of economics. We'd need to see some major economic change and no political change or change in political regime. Because if that's what it would take to falsify Marx, then it seems like this point is like kind of trivial. Like, of course, if you have some major economic change, something political is going to change too. But I take it it's supposed to be something more than that, right?
I'm less sure on that second one, which is what your example is about. But on the first one, at least, I have a really specific idea about what would falsify this claim, right? So, like, I think a really straightforward falsification of historical materialism would be if, like, imagine that we're visited by aliens, you know, who are clearly incredibly technologically advanced. They come visit us in their intergalactic spaceship, and a la what seems to be the case in quite a bit of science fiction, the aliens still have feudal social institutions, right? You know, it's all lords and dukes and stuff. Then that would be pretty powerful evidence. I think it's probably a more interesting challenge on the second part. I'd have to think about that more, but I think that would be, you know, I think it's a little bit easier for the first half to sort of see what would falsify it. You could also actually, or here's a fun one. If the Soviet Union had actually developed a thriving form of socialism as a underdeveloped country in isolation, right? Like that seems like that would be a pretty powerful, you know, refutation of historical materialism. Maybe Marxists wouldn't mind, right? Because they'd prefer the political win to the theoretical refutation, but still seems like it would be.
This is kind of switching subjects a little bit, sure, but have you read Kropotkin at all?
I have read a teensy bit of Kropotkin, like, you know, 20 years ago or something, so you probably know more about Kropotkin at this point than I do.
No, I haven't read that much either. I started reading it like a year or something ago, and I think got distracted, started reading other stuff. But Kropotkin, like, strikes me as an example of, like, if I were going to be a communist, but boy, is that a distant possible world?
Sure.
But if I were going to be one, I think I'd be that kind, right? I mean, he's a pure utopian socialist in the Marx-Engels dichotomy. It's purely moralistic, and he's clearly, this is actually, I guess, what a lot of conservatives think just socialism generally is it's just sort of, it's motivated by this idea that humans are really, really altruistic. And if we just would push ourselves more in that direction, you know, we could see it's actually part of our nature to share our things. And I mean, that's part of what he argues there. But there's just this very optimistic kind of view of human nature behind it. And we don't need to go through all of these historical phases. We just need to recognize our inner potentiality for helping each other out. And I kind of wonder, like, why isn't he bigger on the left? This is a much more benevolent kind of communism.
I don't know, man. I think there's too much anarchism on the left rather than too little. But I'm curious about this sort of thought of the modal counterparts of, you know, the communist Spencers and the other timelines who are attracted to this. That, you know, like what other beliefs around that, right? They would have to change, right? So, like, is it the case that actual world Spencer has like a more pessimistic view about human nature than these ones would have to, or I mean, where do you think the breaking point is between the two?
Yeah, for sure, I'm more pessimistic. For sure, yeah. I am.
Yeah, right. And it's like, so this is my thing has always been that, like, look, how kind and cooperative are humans, you know, by their nature? It's like, I don't know, man, this seems like a really complicated empirical question to me, that it's hard to sort of make big sweeping comments about, you know, one way or the other. Cause you know, I think it's, you know, I mean, I think we're all kind of mixed bags, and we have our kind and cooperative side and our selfish and cruel side. And, you know, I've always liked that. I might have even quoted last time we talked, I don't remember, but I've always liked the David Hume's essay about the immortality of the soul, where he says that we all float between, most of us float between vice and virtue. And he says, you know, problem with like a just God trying to like sort people into who goes to heaven and who goes to hell is that, you know, most of us float between vice and virtue. And, you know, he you know, says if you were going to go around the world trying to sort out the righteous from the wicked, so you could give the righteous a good supper and the wicked a good beating, then, you know, you'd have an incredibly hard time, you know, trying to decide who's right, because everybody's such a mixed bag. So, like, look, I don't know. I don't have a lot of strong opinions about the human nature question, but my point has always been that I actually think the politics of this always seem kind of backwards to me, right? Like in other words, I'm probably the one who's missing something, because most people who, regardless of what sort of normative or political side they're on, right, like, seem to have a different intuition than I do on this. But it seems to me like the political valence of the human nature debate, if anything, kind of should be the other way around, right? Like, in other words, like, hierarchical economic arrangements aren't necessarily that big a deal if you can kind of trust that everybody's going to be kind and benevolent about it, that, you know, that if nobody's going to abuse their power over their, you know, employees, you know, if some people are suffering, don't worry about it, then, you know, other people will just sort of like, you know, solve that problem with like private charity and, you know, all that stuff. Whereas if you, you know, it seems to me that the more you worry that people are going to give into the temptation to abuse their power over one another and will just sort of callously, you know, let each other suffer on a, you know, individual level, then the stronger the case is for more egalitarian and democratic institutions, right? So I mean, I mean, very roughly, the thought would just be that, you know, the more concerned you are that people abuse their power over each other, the better a case you have for spreading out power as evenly as possible.
I agree with that. I just don't think that that gets you to political egalitarianism. If you have, I mean, one way to put the point, I guess, this would be like a Robert Nisbet kind of conservative point, which is that if you've got a state involved, and I know with
Kropotkin there isn't.
Kropotkin, yeah. There's not a state. But if you've got a state involved and then you've got, you know, the masses, everybody's equal, then there's no one who can stand up to the state, you know. You know, the state is then is completely uncheckable. But if you've got, you know, more inequality, there can be other locuses of power outside of the state. So, I mean, this is why Xi Jinping and you know, Vladimir Putin, I mean, they want to get rid of the billionaires. Why? These are people who have consolidated power enough to threaten them. But if you've just got everybody who's...
They don't want to get rid of the billionaires. I mean, Xi and Putin, I mean, they have a... this is like...
Oh, the independent ones. The ones that don't derive their authority from them.
I mean, sure. Like, they want to get rid of the ones who are, you know, who are a problem. But, I mean, like, they don't want to, like... They're not... Neither of those guys have the slightest objection to, like, their being billionaires. They just want the billionaires to be their friends.
But they're subordinates.
Sure, I guess. I mean, I think that to a large extent, especially in the Putin case, you know, I mean, he's the, you know, I think he, yeah, I think he's the, you know, I think he's the leader of a group of oligarchs that, you know, they have a, that like he's kind of the ultimate mob boss of that arrangement. Right. But I mean, I think the others also see him as their guy, right? As the one who's sort of helping them, you know, to secure their power and privileges.
Yeah, I guess maybe another way of putting the point is maybe a part of my pessimism is that I just think if you've got power equally distributed amongst people, it's not going to stay. It's not going to stay equally distributed for long. You're going to get some locus of power, you know, and then you're going to need another one to resist that one. And if you try to smooth them all out, you'll end up with just one strong man and no one to stand up to the strong man.
Yeah. I guess one immediate thought about that is I'd be curious why this doesn't apply. Well, I mean, maybe it would. You said earlier political egalitarianism. So I guess to rephrase this more neutrally, I'm curious how much this is just an objection to economic egalitarianism and how much of it would also apply in the political realm, right? Like is this sort of is this an objection to, you know, because it certainly could be, right? To just having political democracy as opposed to, you know, like they have a under, you know, the sort of political arrangements that you tend to have under feudalism, you have, it's not just like you have the, you know, you have the state and then, you know, all of these citizens, you know, you have like an abundance of separate power centers, right? You know, that the, under that system, right? Like, so, I mean, I guess I'm curious, like, is this to what extent is this also an objection to political democracy or sort of only to economic democracy?
I'm not sure. I will say what disturbs me about feudalism is not that there are these many like lords, but it's that these local centers of powers are like absolute in their domain. You know, you've got, you know, you're completely dependent on them. That seems kind of terrifying. If they're just like employers that I can leave and go to another employer, then it's like, okay.
Yeah. So I think that's the real nub of the disagreement, really, probably right there, right? Like does this sort of power that, you know, that employers have over workers, like, does that seem like way too much? Right. Or does that seem kind of OK? Because given like freedom of exit kind of from one employer to another. Right. You know, which certainly when you think about like the workplace dynamics of, you know, Amazon warehouses or, you know, fast food or et cetera. Right. I mean, like it seems pretty bad to me. that, you know, that for, you know, I mean, if somebody's standardly awake for 16 hours a day, right, you know, for 8 of those hours, that you have this degree of domination, you know, that that the sort of like every detail of, you know, how you comport yourself, you know, during that time is up to somebody who, you know, I think probably all complex organizations have to have a certain amount of operational hierarchy and practice to get things done. But, you know, somebody who really doesn't have any kind of accountability to you, right? You know, that the sort of your only way of exercising power within that arrangement is just to quit. And even that, you don't want to do too many times, right? Because the more you do it, right, like then certainly, you know, unless the labor market's so tight that they can't afford to care, right, then the more you do it, the sort of worse it looks when you're applying for the next job, right? You know, like, so that seems pretty bad, right? It seems like certainly at least, and actually, sorry, I would be like curious about this, because like, just to kind of explore, it's like, look, I kind of know where the opinion, our views diverge in terms of like long-term horizons, right? That like, I think it would be better if we didn't have capitalism at all, right? Like, you know, but I am also curious to what extent they diverge like closer to home than that, right? Like, in other words, like it seems like a really good thing, like civilizationally to me, that we have the sort of power of employers is, to the extent that the power of employers is curbed by like strong labor unions or really strong regulatory state, like those seem like pretty unambiguous goods to me. And I'm curious if we've sort of already diverged on that, or if the divergence is like further out from what already exists.
I guess I want to concede to you that the kind of power that employers have can still be pretty bad. Like, as someone who is on the philosophy job market frequently, you know, for a 1-year contract, it's like, I feel like my position is pretty precarious economically, even though, you know, I'm highly educated. I've got more opportunities than a lot of people. I call it an ideological wormhole where conservatives and Marxists can kind of agree about some of this stuff, like some of the opposition to like wokeness in the workplace and stuff has got people thinking about like, yeah, I mean, I kind of have to keep my mouth shut and work, and that seems kind of not so good. So, yeah, you can find some common ground with conservatives thinking like, yeah, employers can have too much power. Now, what are the mechanisms for checking that? Is it just like a better economy where you have more opportunities? Now, I have some worries about public union, labor unions in particular, and I admit I'm no expert on this. A lot of it looks to me like a kind of lateral exploitation, like it's part of the middle class excluding another part of the middle class. You can raise costs on other people and stuff because you're more organized or something. I'm not very sympathetic to it, but I also don't know enough about it to be, you know, confident.
I would say that, look, if a better economy where you have more opportunities is obviously a good thing, right? Like, I think that that's, you know, going to be hard pressed to find somebody disagreeing with that part, right? You know, but the sort of question is whether it's a sufficient thing, right? Because for one thing, you know, these things are cyclical, and you know, the like it's you know, no economy is good forever, right? You know, so you have the hope would be, and I mean, I'm just like, again, I'm very, very happy to talk about like the sort of like long-term more radical horizons, you know, but like just restricting myself for net to like very like piecemeal reformist things, just because I'm interested in this question of how much the divergence happens even at that level, right? Like, the hope would be that you can achieve things, you know, while the economy is good, right? That that can sort of cushion how bad it is, you know, for workers when it gets bad again, right? If you can like achieve greater job security through unionization, which you're more likely to achieve in conditions of a good economy where it's gonna be harder to replace people, right? You know, then maybe you can have some institutional protections that you could hold on to, you know, during periods of downturn. I mean, like, I know there's also a sort of nest of disagreements that you kind of raised with the point about public sector unionization. I mean, my basic bias about this is that, you know, it doesn't actually seem to me like a lot of, you know, people like public school teachers, for example, are, you know, doing nearly as well as I would like them to, right? Like, I'm certainly not bothered by the idea that they've sort of managed to, you know, coerce too good a deal for themselves.
I think you should be able to fire them for being just grossly incompetent. Like, I think that should be a thing. And I've known some people who were protected by this, where I thought, oh, come on, you're barely even phoning it in.
It could be that maybe once we got into the particulars of these cases, I would agree that your friends should be fired. But like, there is this sort of odd inconsistency, it seems to me, between the view that I often see that, like, oh, we should be like really worried about, you know, too much of a tax burden on rich people, because, you know, even if they have like really good incentives economically for striving and, you know, winning out in market competition, if the incentives aren't quite as good as they would be otherwise, then we're worried they're not gonna lay enough of those golden eggs. With the sort of relative lack of concern that I often see in the context of conversations about like public school teachers, with like, look, I mean, surely, you know, by similar reasoning, we should think that the better a deal we can offer for teachers, you know, the better, you know, candidate pool that you're going to have to choose from and all of that, right?
I mean, I think the market could do a better job on education than what the state is providing. I mean, come on, the civics polling has just like been abysmal, like forever.
Sure, but is that because that, you know, we haven't just like gotten the state out of the education business and let the market do its thing? I mean, I would note, for example, that the country that people often point to as having the best schools in the world,
Finland,
yeah, where they don't even have private schools. I mean, this is the like it's all the state, right? So I think. You know, like more fine-grained policies. I mean, we can kind of talk about a la carte and maybe I'll concede a point here or there, but I'm like, at the view from 10,000 feet level, I am going to be very skeptical about the idea that like the problem with the American education system is that it's not, you know, privatized enough. The big picture thing I would just say is that like, given the global rankings contrasts, I think that grounds sort of general higher order skepticism that about the idea that the problem with the American education system is, you know, too much government involvement.
You have dragged me into a policy debate I wasn't anticipating on or planning for or prepared for.
The Scandinavians
sure. leftists like to like point to the Scandinavians and like, oh, it's working there, that should work here. When there are all sorts of other differences between these countries and stuff. And, you know, I think it's Sweden that has like a more privatized social security or whatever. It's like, okay, the Scandinavians seem to be doing everything right. So I think if they did have a private system, it would probably be working pretty well, because the Scandinavians just make stuff work.
I'm going to shock you here and say that I don't agree with that. I think if you look at like the history of Sweden in particular, I remember one of Thomas Piketty's book a few ago, a lot of it was about this. And, you know, and Sweden, you know, not that long ago, historically, was one of the most unequal countries in Europe. People would sort of mention early 20th century Sweden in like the same breath as Tsarist Russia. And I think that you sort of the Swedish kind of social democratic compact, that kind of, and, you know, similar things that happen elsewhere, right, really kind of emerged as a kind of class compromise as a result of pretty bitter class struggle. I mean, if you look at what happened with the sort of big radical industrial unions in some of those countries in the early 20th century. So I'm very skeptical about the sort of culturalist explanation, but like the sort of more general thing, I'd say, is that, I mean, I do often find that the right seems to be kind of all over the place about what to say about the Nordics. Because I'm not, you know, I want to be careful about this because I don't want to do the thing that annoys the shit out of me when it's done in the other direction, which is like sort of saying like, oh, people with this general political posture say X and Y, but X and Y aren't consistent with each other when it's not the same people saying it. But I do find attempts to solve the Nordics problem on the right, where you sort of have people being like, actually they're really bad, right? Oh, actually, they're really good, but that's because it's their more free market, you know, processes in some ways than there are in the West, which I think is just, you know, empirically not true. We can get into it. Or it's like, okay, well, sure, there's all this socialistic kind of reforms that have been enacted in these places, but what works there wouldn't work here. And certainly to the extent that people are going with option number three, the thing I always want to press them on is the sort of causal mechanisms that make sense, right? Because if it's just sort of saying, because the thing that I see way too often is people just sort of pointing at differences without explaining why these are disanalogies that are relevant to this context, right? Like, you know, people sort of said, oh, well, they're smaller, they're more homogenous. It's like, yeah, okay, true. But like, explain to me causally why this would mean that this or that social democratic policy would work well there, but it wouldn't work well here. Cause otherwise it's just, you know, to steal a line from Nathan Robinson, you know, you might as well say like, oh, well, what works in Norway could never work in the US cause we don't have fjords.
Well, the one I've heard is that they have been much higher social trust countries for a long time. Mm-hmm. And welfare states are more likely to be successful in such countries. That social fact about these countries apparently came before their policy turns. Like, so according to the book, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, there's a discussion about this. It's a pretty amusing book. And it's a mostly left-wing book, but it makes some concessions along the way. But that's one of the things, one of the views that's at least taken seriously in that book is that they had high levels of like social trust, public servants, and that kind of thing, and that accounts for their success. Rather than, oh, they had these redistributive policies, and that's what generates the success. I mean, but I don't know. I'm not a policy expert on this, so
yeah. I mean, that's interesting. I'll check it out.
I want to ask you about something totally different, then.
Yeah, please.
So, one of the things, so you've obviously read a lot more Marx than I have, but one of the things that I think is worth emphasizing, and it's one reason I'm suspicious of Marx, is I think we can talk about various ideologies, not in the Marxist sense, but just in the political belief system sense, as having like motivational or cognitive profiles, as well as like propositional content. If you want to ask, like, what is conservatism? Like, there are different people will define it in different ways, but it seems like it's not just like a list of propositions you accept. It seems like you have to have a certain kind of like maybe warmth towards the established order, maybe combined with some kind of fear or uneasiness with change or certain kinds of change, maybe fear of what strike you as utopian projects and that kind of thing. And let's go to a really bad one, just not because I'm trying to make the comparison with Marxism, but just because this is really clear.
Illustrate it, yeah.
Yeah, as an illustrative point, Nazism. You just can't be a Nazi and not be hateful, right? Like, you know, to be a Nazi is to be hateful. And you could imagine someone who's a convert to the party back in like 1933 or whatever, who like accepts some of this stuff, but isn't really like a hateful person. And they'd be like, Hans, you're just not getting it. You've got to really hate the Jews. You know, you can't just like
accept that there's this problem. You got to really hate them like viscerally. Okay, so I have thought that it's maybe part of the motivational profile of Marxism, at least from the Marx I've read. It seems like he's often very contemptful. He has a contemptful attitude of like the petty bourgeois, and he has this impatience towards the established order of a certain way. And I don't know. I see, like, I can, and this is kind of where I want to put a critical wedge is so you could say, like, with Stalinism, Maoism, all this stuff is like, oh, it's ideologically, it's not propositionally the same as Marxism, particularly because of the Soviet Union skipped a step in development according to Marxist system. Okay. And yet I want to say, but it's got the same motivational profile. Like, you see Marx's contempt, like, distilled and concentrated in Lenin's writings, or at least I do, in State and Revolution, various other things he said. He's just a very, I don't know, there's this ruthlessness to it that I think there you have a thread that you can connect from Marx to these authoritarian regimes that you want to distance and say are not, maybe they're not really real Marxism or something like that. And I'm willing to concede that. I'm like, okay, I'm willing to concede that they're not. And yet they've got the spirit of the original Marx, and it's a bad spirit, is what I think.
I guess one thing I would point out is that it does seem like a lot of what you're describing with Marx, maybe not all of it, but a lot of it, is really the psychological profile of like an intellectual polemicist, right? That like this is that the sort of that being really impatient, being, you know, often seeming, you know, contemptuous of, you know, of people who don't get it, of people who stand in your way. I mean, this is something that it's like, yeah, sure, this could be, you know, you could be talking about Marx. You could also be talking about von Mises, right? You know, you could maybe be talking about Thomas Sowell, right? Like these are people who display a lot of these characteristics in their writing.
I've read Thomas Sowell and I've read Karl Marx, and I do not see the same kind of contempt from Sowell. I do not.
Okay. I will just
von Mises maybe. I don't know. I haven't read much Mises.
I will just register that our vibes, our vibe readings of Sowell are very different. You know, I mean, I see a lot of like, I figured all this shit out and I cannot believe these idiots don't get it. And you know, and haven't, you know, and haven't accepted the obvious truths that I'm laying out here, in Sowell. But, you know, I mean, look, in a certain sense, I do get, you know, what you're saying, maybe, you know, maybe less so with, you know, with Marx, who, I mean, I do see a lot of what seems to me to be sort of justified indignation at manifest injustice that seems maybe not too different from what you get from the sort of pen of like a really savagely critical dissident in one of those countries that you just mentioned. Right. I see that. I also see, you know, I also see a lot of like sort of polemical impatience, and even contempt, you know, with sort of, factional rivals, you know, bourgeois economists, you know, that he's bashing, etc. But, you know, I'm clearly just, you know, I don't really have the sort of sense of bad vibes there that you're describing, but I do get maybe in a different way what you're saying, because like a half joking thing I'll often say, and I actually do kind of mean it, is like the you know, the argument against my politics that I often that gives me most pause is not like, you know, something about calculation problems or libertarian defenses of property rights or anything like this, but just the fact that so many people who agree with me are like insufferable assholes. And that actually does sometimes, you know, give me pause. I will say though, that the thing that maybe balances that out a little bit is that like, this is a feeling that I have a lot when I'm thinking about like, you know, well, whatever, people like me who I interact with online who are like media creatures. But I think about a lot of like other socialists who are, you know, like people who have long histories of doing like, you know, real world activism, union organizing, especially people who are older and have been doing it for a long time. And like, honestly, a lot of those people strike me as like moral saints.
All right. So I think we're going to, I think we're actually going to cut this off there for today, because, there's a fair amount left. We went a little long, at the opening. But this is probably as good a transition as we're going to come to between, our two subjects today. So, we will definitely play, part two of this discussion in a rapidly upcoming episode, but there's also a link below to where you can watch it all now if you're just too impatient to wait for that. But when we're, you know, when we're talking and thinking about you know, about sort of, yeah, that last subject, you know, kind of you know, people who argue about politics online are often incredibly annoying, but actually, you know, true premise. But nevertheless, have a tremendous amount of admiration for people who are involved in often very difficult and thankless kinds of organizing tasks in the real world. That really, I think, brings us as nicely as we can to the conversation we are about to have, with Electra. Since she teaches at Rutgers, I really can't think of a better way to transition this than to, get the set up my own recent trip to Central New Jersey. So I'd been invited a little while ago by the Alliance Jewish Progressives at Princeton to come speak to them, and then once we realized that that wasn't really going to work in the way that was originally anticipated because the encampment was set up and everybody was there, we switched it to there. And we do have like a 40-second clip of this now. I should say in advance, the sound is awful because we couldn't use amplified sound, which is why we're only doing 40 seconds. Princeton has been very strict about that. Apparently, when Chris Hedges came to do one of these there, they had him arrested for using a megaphone, and they banned him from campus for 90 days. Which, granted, I wasn't going to be back in Central New Jersey for 90 days, so I suppose I could have taken my chances, but I would still rather not get arrested. I had like dinner plans later, so no amplified sound, but let's just do the other for 40 seconds that we have here. I do need to make one preliminary comment here, which is just that as a lifelong socialist, I'm obviously a big advocate of taking many different kinds of private enterprise and putting them into various forms of public ownership. So I'm very happy to be speaking here at the site of the future Princeton campus of the Rutgers system, public ownership. So, you know, at least I got a good natured laugh out of a bunch of Princeton students, but also I do totally want to actually do that someday. But on that note, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I was smiling, not because the topic is funny. It's quite the opposite, really, but I thought that, you know, the moral saint's introduction, if I were to be the person you're referring to, would sound pretty hilarious to people who know me intimately and would argue otherwise. But thank you for the introduction. It was overly generous as far as I am concerned, although it could be true for the other activists.
All right.
Thank you for having us.
So Saint Electra teaches it at Rutgers. So you're at Rutgers, Newark?
Rutgers and JD. We're the Federated Department of History. Yes, New York.
Okay, and I am curious, before we get into the sort of primary stuff that we're here to talk about today, we're going to have you back at some point to have like a fuller discussion about this, but I know your academic work does actually heavily overlap with it, with and sort of inform, what we're talking about, right? When we talk about, you know, war and genocide in the Middle East. So, I mean, I know we kind of don't have time to sort of get into that in a fuller way tonight, but do you want to give people a little bit of a flavor of like, you know, what your actual research interests are?
Absolutely. Very little to do with Marx, I'm afraid, to follow up on your previous discussion. The part of Marx's story or history that I'm particularly interested in as of lately is that, you know, his wife had a great contribution in writing more than half of it. I don't know if you know the recent, not that recent, but, you know. Anyway. So what do I do? I'm a historian. I'm an immigrant myself. I came to the U.S. about 11, 12 years ago now. And I find it meaningful to always introduce myself along these lines, because I think other than my identity as a historian and somebody who specializes in the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean broadly defined, I believe it is my identity as a migrant here in the U.S. that also shapes how strongly I feel about this campaign, the involvement of the American government in particular, and how many of us who share in this migrant identity, experts, non-experts across the board, connect and feel very strongly. We have an almost instinctive reaction. And be grateful for an opportunity to explain what I mean by that. But to answer your question, I'm a historian. I'm a professor at the Federated Department of History, Rutgers, New York, and NJD. And I specialize in the many afterlives of the Ottoman Empire. So I focus on what happened in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and how nationalism, colonialism, and imperialism shaped so many of the conflicts and multiple genocides that continue to have devastating implications to this day. So if I can connect my work directly, if I could connect my work directly to the carnage that is currently unfolding as we speak in Gaza, the most meaningful way of doing it is by contextualizing and trying to show how this is not a unique conflict in so many ways. It speaks to the nature of nationalism, colonialism, and the continuation of empire in different ways in these regions and in general after World War I. But also there are certain things about this particular conflict that may make it truly exceptional, right? So it's this twofold character as a case study, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Gaza genocide, whatever you want to call it right now. And in my view, this is beyond any doubt an unfolding genocide, the worst we have witnessed in recent history. I could explain again why I use these words intentionally and forcefully. Whether you want to focus on the long-term process or what's currently unfolding, it is the twofold identity of that conflict, carnage, violent reconfiguration of the region that speaks both to much broader patterns, but also to something that's truly exceptional and hits a nerve with so many other communities, because it's an extreme manifestation of very common and devastating patterns.
Yeah. Well, so obviously I want to talk about this, that, you know, the, this particular manifestation. So, you know, there has, you know, I think that, you know, before we even get into, you know, what specifically you're doing, right, in the campaign in New Jersey mm-hmm. and all that stuff, mm-hmm. right, that the, you know, right now there are a couple of pretty dramatic things that are going on. One is that there, you know, is that Israel has just turned down yet another ceasefire deal, and it's really, you know, which would have freed all of the remaining, you know, Israeli hostages, which is I actually will shout out past guest Eric Levitz here for pointing out that, you know, this is from Netanyahu's office. The war cabinet unanimously decided that Israel continues the operation in Rafah to exert military pressure on Hamas in order to promote the release of our hostages and other goals of the war. And Eric points out that we must reject a ceasefire plan that would secure the release of all of the remaining hostages for the sake of the hostages is some pretty Orwellian stuff, right? Like this is sort of, you know, not really even pretending anymore, right? Because this is, you could have gotten every single hostage at this point free, and they're not doing that. I saw from Haaretz that, in fact, you have these Israeli government statements that are like, there's no circumstances where we would take a ceasefire deal that involved, you know, completely ending the war and not going into Rafah, where a million people already fled because they were told this is the last safe space in Gaza, you know, that you can go to avoid getting killed. And at the same time, right? I mean, there has been this concern that the International Criminal Court might issue, you know, arrest warrants for you know, Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders because of the genocide, which got a really unhinged response with the Republican response to the ICC. Yeah, so the thing, I guess we don't have the full original, you know, threat from this Republican politician.
Yeah, I could pull it up and read it, but it is the font was really small, so it wouldn't have made a good graphic.
Okay, yeah, but it was something along the lines of like, there's going to be like if Israeli leaders are, you know, actually faced with accountability at the ICC, then, you know, they'll sure regret it and we'll sanction them. We'll sanction their family, you know, families of the judges. There's, you know, it's very, you know, I will note that the one thing I don't hear in any of that is, oh, they'll surely beat the case because they're obviously innocent.
It's just that, I mean, that's the Republican Party, right? And there are no words to describe the Republican Party anymore. But what's particularly frustrating to me, or frustrating, doesn't begin to describe how I feel, is how the so-called Democratic Party is responding to the ruling party, the government yeah. is responding to all that. That brings us directly to the uncommitted campaign as well. Because we can criticize or make fun or express our outrage and devastation with the Republican Party, but what I'm particularly outraged, almost irate about at this point, is the Democratic Party. That is the ruling party, fully responsible for enabling this current genocide, unapologetically so. And their statements regarding the ICC case as well are not any different than those of the Republican Party. they said that the ICC does not have jurisdiction to try Netanyahu or to decide the case. Mind you, these are the people who coerce us to vote for them, at least some of us, the idiots among us, such as myself, who voted for Biden against their better judgment, and I will publicly declare my shame for that, by promising to end the forever wars, to return some type of normalcy, which wasn't necessarily the best case scenario, but was seen as preferable to what was there before. Many of us who supported Bernie Sanders and believe that we can negotiate something within the Democratic Party that could be better than the Trump disaster. And now the ICC and ICJ, they were criticizing nonstop Trump for like promoting the isolation of the United States of America, for destroying our international standing, even from a conservative, good, all good American imperialism perspective. They were promising a return to normalcy. And what we're witnessing right now is shameful, truly shameful levels of cruelty, incompetence, and this faggish approach to politics. Honestly, I cannot think of any other term than this is how thugs behave to describe both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party.
Yeah,
the uncommitted initiative, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, since right now, essentially, you know, the difference, you know, on whatever, you know, there might be on other issues, the difference on this issue is between that sort of dry statement that the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction and sort of these sort of lurid threats against the institution, or more generally, it's the difference between Biden sort of saying every 2 weeks or having a leak every 2 weeks saying that he's, you know, increasingly frustrated and not even having that pretense. So that's not much of a difference at all. So so yeah, I want to hear about the uncommitted campaign in New Jersey. I have. You know, I mean, I vote in California, where I pointlessly wrote in a ceasefire to my presidential primary ballot, even though nobody's going to count it. This way, you know, with these uncommitted campaigns in states where that's possible, you know, you actually do have a way of sort of registering that's going to show up in the results. The fury about Gaza, and there have certainly been several states where that's. You know, that's gotten, you know, pretty shockingly big numbers, you know, places like Michigan and Wisconsin, you know, that got, you know, that got much more, like the uncommitted vote, you know, was like much more than what, like the, you know, Trump or Biden margins of victory had been in the last couple of elections, which should certainly, you know, which would certainly make a pretty powerful statement, if anything would, right? So, how is this looking in New Jersey right now? And when is the actual...
Yeah, it's June 4th, and to your listeners from New Jersey, June 4th is an important day to keep in mind, and I've shared with you already the website that the volunteers have prepared, which is wonderful, and they can find information there. So June 4th, New Jersey is always the last one, and it's, you know, the bluest of the blue. So it's usually, the argument is that New Jersey doesn't really count. It's a Democratic state. It's not a swing state. It's the last primary. So it doesn't really matter. Well, this year, it truly matters. And because we are the last ones, we had time to prepare. The uncommitted campaign right now is just a statement. We are trying to express something. I love the term fury. It perfectly captures how I feel about so many things as we speak. So right now we are trying to make a statement. And the first inspiration came from Michigan when the Muslim community there, there are people who are mourning, hundreds of their family members who are being murdered as we speak, slaughtered with their tax money, right? So it started with Michigan. It was like a desperate attempt to to express the devastation with the charade that we're witnessing, that we're negotiating with the Democratic Party that is killing the family members of American citizens, and they're still trying to find a way to agree on what? How many of our family members are, you know, it's okay to kill for us to agree to negotiate with? It's unthinkable. And despite the fact that I'm not Palestinian myself, this is what I was trying to say before, that it's the type of atrocity that speaks to every single immigrant in this land. So before I explain in a more articulate way, hopefully, what the uncommitted is, I really want to share this with you from my own point of view and why I decided to become involved with all this. The migrant identity is, I believe, truly important. So many of us came to this country for all kinds of reasons, and we made a choice. We made the choice to stay here and to make a commitment to this country, right? To work, to pay our taxes, to start families or not, have a cat, you know, regardless of what our choices might be, we are making a commitment and a choice. So imagine that if you feel like your choice and your tax money is now used to kill your family members, which is something that could happen to me and many others. We know very well that American imperialism, because this is what we're talking about, does not really care. I could very well become, the same thing could become an unfolding tragedy in any region. In fact, we come from all kinds of places that have had a taste of what imperialism looks like, right? Either dictatorships here and there, losing half of Cyprus at some point from the perspective of Greek nationalism. So we're all very, very familiar with how much our cultures, our families, whatever we identify as a homeland, which is not in the Marxist definition of the sense of socioeconomic construct, but it's something unspoken and almost instinctive, subconscious, a subconscious need to belong with something, a land, an idea of a land, a culture that is familiar to all of us. So this idea that they don't care, they simply don't care, the complete dehumanization of Palestinians that are slaughtered right in front of our very eyes with our money. And we're still talking about, it's unthinkable to me and many others, that we're still talking about the massacre, the slaughter of 20,000 children. And as you said, Rafah is under invasion. Like, clearly Netanyahu is not going to stop because he's desperate and he has no way out. And we're still talking about it as if it's something we could negotiate. So this message that has been delivered to every single immigrant in this land, that we couldn't care less about all of you, really. And even if you are American citizens, right, your families don't matter. The fact that it could be me, that for my petty privileges, as an American citizen who made that choice, I now pay the taxes that are going to be used to buy the weapons that will be killing my family members, is something that really hit a nerve with me, and I believe with many, many other migrants from all walks of life. So this is very important and relevant to the character of Uncommitted. So it was a spontaneous initiative. It started with Michigan, right, with the Muslim community there being very central, but I think it connected many people, migrants. First and foremost, the migrant identity is very central, but also many people who have a problem with the complete collapse of American democracy. Again, Biden was elected to restore American democracy, procedural democracy, let's say. We're not under the illusion that everything is working perfectly, but we do have a procedural democracy, right? Allegedly, we do vote. We elect a government and we make a certain deal with said government to respect, somewhat respect, what they're supposed to be standing for. So the complete, unapologetic violation of all of these norms is offensive to many. So as we were witnessing the continuous slaughter of civilians in the first live genocide, like broadcasted live in human history, for 5 months, at some point, people started coming. We were protesting. We were signing petitions. We were doing all kinds of things. But the overwhelming frustration of how weak we are, nobody seemed to care, quite frankly, inspired many of us to look at Michigan. At the end of the day, the only thing that they might care, I'm not even that sure that they care about that at this point, but they might care about winning the election, presumably. So maybe we should focus on doing something more substantial other than just protesting and trying to raise awareness, given that the Biden administration doesn't seem to care at all. And to give them the message that we are the registered voters, we are registered Democrats, we do vote, given that the argument is always, oh, these young people, and I'm not talking about myself, but most of the people who have been really energized and participating in this campaign are very young, and that captures a generational shift, among other things. So the argument is that these people don't vote, they don't matter, who cares? As long as we convince the 60, 70-year-olds that wake up in the morning and go there and cast their little ballot that, you know, CNN or NBC have your back, and the New York Times are telling you the truth and nothing but the truth, forget about the youth. They don't matter. So I guess the main point behind this initiative is to show them that they're voters in this country, and we can mobilize them in big numbers that are not going to vote for you. And the reason for that is because you are committing a freaking genocide in front of the whole world without a shred of shame at this point, in a way that is destructive, first and foremost, to the Palestinian victims, but also to Judaism, considering this whole ridiculous and completely undemocratic discussion about anti-Semitism, which is anti-Semitic in and of itself. The only true anti-Semitism we can identify right now is how the government is using anti-Semitism, if you ask me, to take away from American Jews and Jewish communities in general their right to decide what Judaism means to them. It is completely insane. So it's destroying Palestinians. It's the brutality, the sadistic violence on the ground is really unbearable. And I'm not going to apologize for being emotional about it, quite frankly. I bring it up because this is the other argument, which is very offensive that we hear very often, that this is an emotional reaction. Absolutely. That's what makes a human, to have an emotional reaction when children and babies and people who are vulnerable are getting slaughtered right in front of our very eyes. But even if it weren't an emotional reaction, as a very rational professor of history, right, with an expertise in the Middle East, I find it so ridiculous that everybody feels entitled to lecture us to how problematic it is to be emotional, and that there is somehow a rational explanation. There isn't. There is absolutely no rational explanation for what's happening. And some nuance that it's somehow lost on us. There is absolutely no nuance. What's happening is like the frenzy of nationalism and paranoid type of carnage that is used and abused only by war criminals who benefit from that. This is the only logical explanation I can think about the whole situation. It's not the first time in human history, it won't be the last one. But what I was saying is that the Palestinians are clearly victimized, brutalized, dehumanized. Jewish communities are dehumanized, given that apparently they don't have the right to decide what Judaism is, right? That if you are a pro-genocide Jew, you're an anti-Semite. You can only be Jewish, according to this legislation, if you're pro-genocide. So anti-genocide Jews are not Jewish. Pro-genocide Jews are the true Jews. and that somehow is good for the Jewish community. It's, and quite frankly, it's a disaster for Israel as well, right? Even if one tries to argue that we care about Israel and the old-fashioned diplomacy of our main military base in the Middle East, how is Israel going to overcome this? I really struggle to see how they're going to survive all this. So it's a disaster to all actors involved. The only ones who benefit from this slaughter are those who profiteer from arms manufacturing. It's so idiotic, honestly, that at times we think it must be a bigger conspiracy. It can't be as simple as that. But unfortunately, this seems to be the only logical explanation. This is a disaster for everybody involved, and it seems to come down to some petty profiteering, like let's just make a few more billions here and there and continue. What if we, you know, lose control of the situation because we're playing with fire and we don't know what the heck we're doing? We could well start World War III and, you know, destroy the world as we know it. But if we can just continue this for a few more months and make a few more billions and pass, a few more deals by breaking American laws and violating international law and completely destroying any remaining credibility the U.S. might have had as a superpower, who cares? As long as, you know, the deals, we see our little deals through. It is so stupid that it's truly very difficult to believe that this is what it is about, but I really struggle to find any other logical explanation. Given that this is a disaster for all actors involved. I mean, Netanyahu is way too involved right now to stop, right?
Well, I mean, he's also gonna, like, it's, you know, he was very unpopular before the war started. He was facing all these criminal charges. I mean, presumably he has every incentive in the world to just keep it going for as long as he can, right? Because this is his political and legal survival. But I know Jake, you had a question you want to ask.
Yeah, just really interested about tactics, because my understanding of other uncommitted campaigns, and I could be completely wrong here, but is the implicit idea that, let's say, Biden changed his behavior, right? We're not committed, but we would vote for Biden against Trump if there was a big improvement. But I was wondering, is that something, like, let's say when you're canvassing or convincing people, is it more the idea that we would still potentially vote for Biden if there was a change in his Israel-Palestine policy? Or is it more just that, like, we're so angry that we are not committing and there's no, that's not part of, like, the tactical calculus at play here? I'm just curious.
So to be frank, there is no tactical calculus, right? It was a very spontaneous reaction. Every state was different, starting with Michigan, perhaps as a negotiation. Maybe people were desperate at trying to say, listen, you will lose the election over this. Please stop right now. But he didn't, and he gave everybody the message that he couldn't care less about what we have to say. So at this point, by the time it comes to New Jersey, it's just an expression of fury. There is no way we're voting for Biden. There is nothing this man can do, as far as I am concerned, to change this at this point. And I think that captures the majority sentiment. Now, committing to the uncommitted or pledging does not mean anything, right? You can vote for the uncommitted during the primaries and then go and vote for Biden or Trump. So it's clearly a symbolic statement. But as far as I am concerned, it's an expression of frustration and fury. And people are canvassing. It's very interesting because at the beginning, when we're talking about strategies, we want to make this statement and to have large numbers in order to show that this is really important to the American voter, and especially people who are leaning Democratic. So when we were talking about strategies, that idea was central at the beginning, right? Not to alienate Democrats. But now, as people are, like, making phone calls and all that, the stories they're sharing are that the opposite strategy may be more efficient because they're calling registered Democrats and they're hanging up on them when they bring up the primaries. And the response is like, F you, there's no way I'm voting for Biden. I'm voting for Cornel West. And then it's just, well, maybe we should start by saying that this is not an attempt to save Biden because there's no salvation for him. And this is how we truly feel, most of us, despite the fact that this is not a homogenous movement. But it looks like this is what resonates actually with large numbers of registered Democrats as well, that they don't even want to talk about it. Or they hang up on people when they hear anything about the primaries and they're, no, we're not voting. We're not participating. So we have decided to change the message to reflect how we truly feel. And that means, seems to be the better strategy as well, right? That this is not an attempt to save Biden, because at this point that sounds ridiculous. Clearly, this is not something that can change. There is nothing left in Gaza. I'm sorry, I have no words to describe the depths of cruelty, incompetence, corruption, and sinister violence. Quite frankly, I'm not even sure Biden is aware of what's going on at this point. And he was always somebody who was in favor of warmongering. He was a big supporter of the Iraq war. He was unapologetically so on the wrong side of history regarding foreign policy, even with the Republicans in charge. And I believe he's part of the people who had a very disastrous influence over the Democratic Party as a whole. But at this point, he's just like a sad old man whom they parade around trying to convince us as we witness his slow motion collapse, right? He's mixing names, forgetting dates, falling off the stairs right in front of our very eyes. And they're still trying to convince us that this is in the global superpower. We cannot find anybody better than this, a man who is possibly truly unfit for office to represent us. So the whole thing is just an expression of decadence. Somebody mentioned Weekend at Bernie's at some point to me, and it really clicked with me. Not only as far as Biden is concerned, but it's a manifestation of a broader system in full collapse that is already expired and dead, if you ask me. And this is why we see these very violent reactions against the students as well, right? It is over. It is breakfast or weekend at Bernie's. And this is just the final act, which is particularly cruel and ridiculous, as it often happens when all kinds of regimes reach the final stage of decadence.
I actually remember looking this up a little while ago, and the last couple of Soviet leaders before Gorbachev, Brezhnev and Andropov had both died in office as what were widely considered to be very old men. And I actually looked, I got curious and I looked up their ages, and they were both significantly younger than Biden and Trump both are now. I guess being the Soviet Union during World War II would age you, but still, I would say that that's maybe a symptom of a system that it's very gone in a direction where it might be increasingly hard for sort of new politicians to come up who can sort of convincingly pretend to have a vision of the future to sell you. Whereas maybe if you've been doing it since the 70s, it's a little bit easier to say your lines. But to what you were saying about Biden and like sort of the strategic calculus or lack thereof. I mean, I remember after the uncommitted vote in Wisconsin, which also got vastly more than 2.5 times, I think, as much as the gap between Trump and Biden in the 2020 election. So after that vote happened, I wrote an article about this for Jacobin called "Democratic Voters Are Furious About U.S. Support for Israel," and as part of that, I talked to Natalia Latif from the National Uncommitted Movement, who was in Wisconsin at that time. And one of the things that she told me, which stuck with me, was she said, well, look, this isn't a, you know, we see this as a descriptive effort, not a prescriptive one. In other words, we're not telling anybody what they should do in November. They'll have to decide that, right? You know, when it comes to it, we're giving people a chance to register, you know, how they feel right now. And then, like, as far as, like, you know, whether Biden, you know, there's anything he can do now to win some of those people back, or, you know, probably a lot of them, there's nothing he could do, and what he could do if he could win over some of them, that's kind of his problem to figure out, right? Like, what we're doing is we're giving a chance for the scope of that, you know, to reveal itself, to sort of show, look, this is how many, you know, this is how many people right now feel this way, and then the politicians can kind of do what they want with that. I really want to continue on this, and especially because you, you know, toward the end of what your last thing you were saying, you were bringing up the campus protests, which is where I want to pick up when we restart the discussion. I will say, probably for the sake of time right now, we should go to the post game, but we do have St. Electra for the post game. So this is last time I make that joke, I promise. But we do have her for the post game. So we will, when we pick up, we are going to continue on the campus protests. If you are a patron, you should have the link. If you are not, you know, then I don't know what you're doing with yourself, but go to patreon.com/BenBurgess. You can sign up. So if you are, we will see you there in about 2 minutes. Left is best.